today, Whole Foods is donating 5% of their proceeds to KPCW. So for the next 2 hours, we'll be broadcasting live from their cafe and speaking with a number of directors whose films are entered in this year's Sundance Festival.
That's right. We've got interviews lined up with the directors of 6 Sundance films and documentaries, including
Racing Extinction, an environmental documentary from Louis Sayhoyas, How to Change the World, a documentary about Greenpeace by Jerry Rothwell, and Fresh Dressed, a fashion documentary directed by Sasha Jenkins.
That's in the first hour of the show. In the second half, we'll speak with the directors of Ivy, a drama from director Tolga Karachelik, Princess, a drama from director Tali Shalom Azir, and Meru, a documentary on mountain climbing from Jimmy Chin and Elizabeth Chai Vassarari.
If you have any interest in mountain climbing and you think the recent ascent of the Donwell was amazing, wait till you hear about the ascent of Meru.
That's right. That's all coming up over the next 2 hours live from Whole Foods Cafe here at Kimball Junction. It's KPCW's Sundance Reel, sponsored in part by the Sky Wellness Collection. And it all gets started right after these... all right, we're going to skip some of our underwriters and sponsors.
It all gets started right now.
Right now. Right now. Let's go. And our first guest...
Is Travis Harkness, the marketing specialist here at Whole Foods. Travis, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to have you guys in the store.
So how's the Sundance rush going so far? Is the store managing to handle all the guests?
Yeah, so far it's been great. It's, you know, we get crazy fluctuations in business where things can be eerily quiet and then just we get ransacked, and it's fun. It's a lot of... A lot of great energy in the store right now.
Fantastic. Well,
talk a little bit about the community giving project. What does that involve?
Great, yeah. So what it's actually called our Community 5% Day. So once a fiscal quarter, so 4 times a year, we donate 5% of our store sales to worthy nonprofits that are true stewards of our community. And KPCW definitely falls in line with that.
Okay. Who else during the course of the year receives or is part of the organizations?
The most recent before you guys was the Kimball Arts Center. And, geez, I'd have to think a little bit behind past that.
Recycle Utah?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I think Recycle Utah was the one prior
another
to that.
Another one. Okay, great. So 5% of today's proceeds will go to KPCW.
That's right.
That's like hundreds of dollars.
At least
per customer, I meant. Per
yes,
customer.
We've had some
per household.
We've had some impressive rings so far.
Per express ring. Okay, so that's the idea. If you're in the area, if you had some shopping to do today, you want to support KPCW, come on down to Whole Foods here at Kimball Junction and spend a few dollars, and 5% of that, of what you spend, or the proceeds of that, will go to KPCW.
Yeah, that's right. 5% of whatever you spend will go straight to KPCW today.
Okay.
So another giving program that you guys have, it has to do with the bags, right? Reusable
yes.
bags.
That's right. Yeah, it's the next program is called Your Change Creates Change. And this program has actually evolved over the years. It used to be, once again, one recipient per quarter. And it has evolved to three simultaneous recipients at our registers. So if you bring in your own bags, for each bag that you bring in for your groceries, you have 10 cents so that you can either take that off of your bill or donate that to the current active recipients for that program. And right now we have the Park City Cooperative Preschool, the Summit Land Conservancy, and Friends of Animals Utah.
Fantastic. I like that name. I don't think I ever knew the program was called Your Change Creates Change.
Your Change.
I
nice.
I like that. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about this, the store or the company's sustainability policies, what you're doing over the years, how things may have changed year in and year out.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, I've said it before, one of the most difficult things as a marketing specialist for Whole Foods is effectively communicating everything it is that we do as a store. You know, there's from animal welfare standards to seafood sustainability ratings to, and most recently, this fall, we launched a produce responsibly grown rating system, where just increasing the level of transparency, where we actually rate our own farmers, where we source our crops from, and give them a good, better, and best rating system based on their agricultural practices and their impacts on the environments where they operate.
So how does that system work? That sounds potentially labor-intensive. Like, does each farm have to get visited? And
Yeah. It's audited by a third party that we source, and we absorb that cost as a company. And the ratings are based on standards that we basically set up. Across the board. Our animal five-step rating system. These systems of transparency and quality ratings previously didn't exist. So we're making these standards up as we go along.
Right.
Got to start somewhere.
Well, yeah. Like all cutting edge programs and activities. So I'm an asparagus farmer. I provide asparagus for Whole Foods.
This is a hypothetical situation.
Could be a business venture too.
It's a proposition.
Yeah. So you're going to come to my asparagus farm and inspect my crop for certain standards. Is that basically how it unfolds?
Yes.
Okay. And if I meet those standards, I get, depending on how well I do, I'm going to get a good, better, and best rating. And then that's going to show up on my asparagus package that you show on the shelf?
Yeah, yes. As this program evolves, all of our produce will be ranked, and we are going through that process now. But essentially, yes, at the point of product where, the pricing and the labeling, it will reveal the farm, the location, and the rating that farm received.
Can you give us a sense of what kind of things you're rating the farmer on? Is it obviously, let's say, chemicals that might be applied to the crop?
Yeah, definitely.
Herbicides or pesticides, that type of thing?
Yeah, it's we have a pretty comprehensive list.
Yeah.
But it's in terms of water efficiency and conservation, protection, waste reduction, responsibility, maintaining your ecosystems and biodiversity where it is that you're practicing your farming. We test soil health, making sure that is being responsibly treated. And there's a whole brochure. We have those available in our produce department if it's something that you're
really
interested in learning more about.
Good.
So I have to ask about seafood, because Chris and I have definitely done several shows related to environmental issues with various seafood that we eat. So how does your system work there, and how does that help the consumer to understand what they're buying?
Sure. So it's a little bit different in terms of our ratings with that. We have third-party auditors for that as well. We have the Monterey Bay Aquarium and what's the other one, the MSC, which is
Marine Stewardship Council.
Marine Stewardship Council.
Very good.
That's it. So those are our third party auditors that basically inform us in terms of seafood sustainability by variety of fish. So if something is not a sustainable variety of fish, we won't sell it, essentially. So if there's a concern with its availability or of its future in the ocean, we won't carry it in our store.
Right. So you're looking out to, say, Chilean sea bass, to make sure that those Chilean sea bass are caught using proper methods and techniques and within, certain seasons or so from certain locations. That's what the... What is it?
Stewardship Council.
Marine Stewardship Council.
Tripping us up today.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really looking at trends of those varieties of fish and relying upon these the Marine Stewardship Council and the Monterey Bay Aquarium to inform us of which varieties of fish are sustainable at this time, to feel comfortable to carry in our store.
Well, it sounds like given these standards that you've developed for not only fish, but now fruits and vegetables and all the crops like that, that we should pretty much have nothing from China.
Always our policy.
You knew I was going there, Travis.
Well, I can't speak with full confidence
on
that.
Okay, well, we're going to check on that during break. We'll have our research team look into that. Because these are high standards. Going back to the fruits and vegetables responsibly grown program you have, you are, like you say, you're covering soil health, impacts to the air, energy, and climate, the farmer's waste practices and waste reduction, farm worker welfare, which I was curious about. Labor practices or so. You're evaluating that. Whole Foods is evaluating that. Water conservation, like you said, its effects on the nearby ecosystems, the local bees and butterflies and insects, and then pest management in general. So those are all really encouraging things. And this just got launched?
This fall, yes.
This got fall? Okay. And you guys, like I say, you're on the cutting edge, so you're learning as you go and how to fine-tune that so you get... So a farmer gets rated good, better, and best. And if they're below good, they're not going to be showcased and they're not going to be in the store.
Yeah, it will not get a rating, and they will have to reapply for that.
Okay.
So I want to ask about how much independence each local store has to source locally, local food, and how much of that is sort of controlled by the, you know, chain overall.
Yeah, so you know, we work pretty closely as a metro. You know, there's 5 stores in the state of Utah at this point, and we have what we call a local foraging team that is always actively, you know, heading to farmers markets and you know, having an open dialogue with the community in terms of you know, products that we think should be in the store, and you know, and then you know, the conversation almost immediately starts of, you know, what our quality standards are and if these products fall in line with what it is, you know, we stand for as a company. And, you know, we have a handful of ingredients that that simply can't exist in products that we sell within the store. And so, yeah, it's definitely something that is a priority for us, maximizing the local presence in our store and carrying as much local product as we can. It's obviously gets a little bit difficult being, you know, on the edge of the desert, but so right. We don't get as much produce and that sort of thing as we would like, or as maybe the California stores do. But
right.
But yeah, it's definitely something that is an absolute priority for us as a company.
Well, fantastic. We have to start wrapping up, but let us know where we can go to find more information about these programs.
Yeah, most recently we just launched a whole our first national campaign as a company, and it's if you go to wholefoodsmarket.com/valuesmatter, you can learn about our values as a company and our quality standards across the board, across all of our departments. And there's a lot of information there, and you know, we're proud of what we stand for as a company and transparency that we offer to our customers.
Fantastic.
All right, Travis Harkness, he's the sustainability director, a coordinator with Whole Foods here at Kimball Junction. Thank you again for chatting with us and sponsoring us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for being in the store.
5% day, 5% give back day for KPCW. Really appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here, you guys. It's a lot of fun every year.
Come on down. We're here at the cafe, live, speaking with directors, and we're going to be speaking with our first director, Luis Sayhoya. He is the director
of Racing Extinction, Luis Sayhoyas. Welcome.
Well, let's just go right here. Luis, right here. Let's go. We'll get our underwriters in a little later. We got Luis. Let's go.
That's right. So Luis Sayhoya's film, The Cove, from the 2009 Sundance Film Festival, exposed viewers to the brutal practice of dolphin slaughter. The Academy Award-winning director now bears witness to a global problem, mankind's role in precipitating mass extinction, potentially resulting in the loss of half the world's species. So Luis, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So give us, you know, just the quick thumbnail sketch of what this film focuses on, if
well,
that's possible.
Yeah, you sort of gave it away, I guess. But I don't know if I'd go see that movie the way you described it. You know, there's been my own backstory is I was a photographer for National Geographic over the course of about 20 years. I did 4 stories on the Mesozoic. That's the midlife of the planet. And when I was actually here 5 years ago with The Cove, I took 2 books with me. One was by a buddy of mine who's the curator of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, Michael Novacek, and he wrote a book called Terra. And I, you know, after the, you know, the first day I got here, I picked up this book, and he's talking about the sixth major extinction that's going on right now. And I thought, oh my God, that's depressing. So I picked up the other book I read. I was reading at the time, and it was A Reef in Time, and it's about the Great Barrier Reef and how that reef is now declining, and it's because we're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction. And I thought, I did a book on paleontologists. I wrote one, and I thought, how do I not know this? And I thought, this is the biggest story in the world. And so that began this journey that led me 5 years later to here. And, you know, my whole thing is, how do you make a film that's really, I think, you know, the most important, pressing story of our times, and make it not just informational, but get it entertaining? And like The Cove, it's an eco-thriller. So, right. You know, when I describe this film, it's like The Avengers, but it's real. You know, we have the real-life Iron Man in our movie. You know, Elon Musk, who is the inspiration for the Iron Man character, you know, Tony Stark in the Iron Man movies, he's in our film. And he does amazing things. And it's all wrapped around, how do we stop? I mean, you look at a guy like him, and, you know, he owns Tesla. He's the biggest installer of solar in America. He's building reusable rocket ships to supply the space station. The guy's like, you know, 40 years old. And, you know, to me, he's like a huge inspiration for a younger generation. Say, listen, the way we've been doing, you know, our business in this world is unsustainable. How do we make it better? And when he built the Tesla, like the Tesla S, it wasn't just the best electric car in the world. It's the best rated car ever made. And what we did, you know, one of the characters in our film is actually a Tesla. We turned it into like a, you know, a Bond vehicle. Because we wanted something that was really cool. I love tech toys. One way that we broke into The Cove is that The Cove is also sort of like an Ocean's 11 film. It's about a unique group of characters that come together, all with special skills. We had world champion freedivers that come together. We have military gear that we use to break into The Cove. It feels like an espionage film, right? And The Cove, it's the next film, Racing Extinction. We have all the same people back, but the toys are bigger and better. And the car has an electroluminescent paint job. We can change the color of the car on the flick of a button. First car ever in the world to do that. We have a forward looking infrared camera that comes out of the frunk, is what they call it. Whether it's normally an engine on an internal combustion engine car, we put a camera there that comes up out of the hood, and it actually can see the hidden worlds of greenhouse gases like, you know, carbon dioxide and methane.
Right. So the film is about extinction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but you got to get people into theater by having a cool story. The first two acts are about extinction, but what it really picks up after any act at the end of Act Two, since Aristotle, you want to give people something that's going to bring them up, and that's what we do.
Nell and I host a show on environmental issues every week. That's our challenge, because many of our stories have an angle to them that can be quite gloomy or so, and yet another story about, oh, this animal threatened, this watershed going dry, this population becoming unsustainable, etc. So you're right. So we're always trying to bring out something that's positive out there, something that's upbeat.
Here's the cool thing I think about the solutions to the mass extinction. They're all upgrades. Everything that you can think of to rid the world of this problem is actually an upgrade. When we did The Cove, I did a carbon assessment of what it took to make that film, and I was horrified. The worst thing you can do to the environment is make a movie about it. You know, I put 646 tons in the first 2 years of production of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I changed the way we got our energy around, you know, that film. We installed 120 solar panels. I now generate 140% of the energy we need for just home and work off the roof. Which means in December, the darkest month of the year, I get a check from the electric company for excess energy production.
Right.
I've been driving electric cars in town for the last 7 years, and the license plate on it says VUS. It stands for Vehicle Using Sun. It's the opposite of an SUV. I don't pay for gas. I pull up to my house and I charge it into the sun. It's like, it's such a beautiful thing to thumb your nose at the fossil fuel company is doing the stuff that where you actually get money back. Yeah, you're driving, you know, without paying for gasoline. When people are, you know, crying about $4, you know, a gallon gas, it's like, gas was like last century, folks, you know.
So last century. So extinction is like you said, it's the biggest issue in the world. How do you bring that down to, a local scale or something sort of more easily understandable?
The biggest driver of extinction is habitat destruction for food for human consumption. And the way we're doing it is extremely unsustainable. We are at a Whole Foods. John Mackey, who runs this place, I'm talking about another film. He's actually a vegan. So am I. All protein comes from plants. Every single bit of it. Whether you eat a cow, a pig, a chicken, or a fish. And so what we're doing, when we mow down the rainforest of South America, where we're killing all these species in a hot zone, is we're using that to raise, let's say, soybeans that we're going to feed the cows that we're going to eat. It's an incredibly unsustainable practice. And John Mackey at Whole Foods knows this.
Right.
Everybody knows this in the environmental movement. And so what we need to do, with 7.2 billion people, soon to be 9 billion, all eating animal products, we need to get off of this unsustainable thing where we're eating wild animals or eating animals that are eating the protein from plants, and then we eat the middleman.
Right.
I would say just cut out the middleman.
Right. Very inefficient linkages in protein production or consumption.
Yeah, if you look at the greenhouse gases that are caused by raising animals for food consumption, it exceeds the greenhouse gases than all the greenhouse emissions from the entire transportation sector. So the best thing you can do to save the environment, to save the wild, is to eat more vegetarian meals three times a day. You can practice saving the earth three times a day. I mean, to me, it's the perfect solution. That's at a very basic level, and that's
right.
Something everybody needs to, should do, and not just for their own health, but the health of the environment. Getting off of fossil fuels, just fine. We found a creative way to do it, with solar panels and electric cars. Certainly the best thing you can do is bike or walk more, but, electric cars are far more efficient. Even if you're getting the energy from coal and then you're using it from the grid to feed your electric car, it's still a better solution than internal combustion engines. So I hope people have more creative ways of getting off of fossil fuels than we did. But that's what the film's really built, is to inspire people to come up with their own ideas.
Right.
So I watched the trailer for it, and it seems kind of like high adrenaline. Is that accurate? I mean, it's
thrilling. The film rocks. I mean, the way I make the film is a film that I'd want to see. It doesn't feel like a documentary.
Informative, informational.
Yeah, you're going to get the exposition on the way, in the way to a story that's actually, hopefully impactful. So all the films I do is I care about is when you're in the audience and you're looking at that screen, every second of it is exciting. It's there for a reason. We thought about it. It's not filler. This is like it's like the Avengers but real. I wanted to make it fun. I wanted to make it so my kids could see it. Both my kids are coming in from different parts of the planet today to see it tomorrow. I'm actually really proud of this film, because a lot of great Hollywood directors I met said, after a first successful film, a director shouldn't make a second one. That always sucks. And this is my second film.
Right.
And so what I want to disprove that. I want to, to me, this film is heavier than The Cove. It's sort of like I would compare it to, it's more Pulp Fiction than it is Reservoir Dogs. But it's a film that's exciting. It's full of adventure. It's like a Bond film. We have all these great tech toys. We bust bad guys, doing horrible things to the planet. And it's fun to watch. It's like, we have a higher bar than most Hollywood films. The Hollywood producers, all they care about the audience is we need to get butts in seats. They look at you and I as $10 in a box of popcorn. What I do is I look at, we not only need to get people into theater, we need to entertain them at the same time, at the same level. And when they get out of the theater, what we need to do is educate them that, we have to change our lives. And so my bar is to, look at people at the theater as minds and seats, and then inspire those people to action when they get out of it. It's a very, more difficult, higher bar than most films.
Because like you're saying, business as usual is not going to win the day here. We're in the middle of our sixth extinction, and this is probably the first extinction of those six that is human-based.
Yeah, well, the last one was 65 million years ago when we were little rodents.
Those were out of our hands. But this one is actually going to be generated by us.
Yeah,
it is being generated by us.
Yeah, this new epoch is called the Anthropocene. It means the age of man. And, you know, our own species name, Homo sapiens, means wise ones. And how wise is that when one species is wiping out maybe half the species on the planet by the end of the century? What we're doing now is, you know, never been done in history. And here's the interesting thing. To me, that is not a downer. What that means is that we're the last generation on the planet that actually can affect the change that we need. So when you, you know, this is the kind of situation that's so epic, so large, and so immediate that we can't wait to solve the problem for our kids to grow up. It's us. Everybody in this room, everybody listening out there in radio land, everybody has to get off their chairs and do something every single day to solve this issue. If you don't, you know, in the Cove, I say that you're either an activist or an inactivist. And when you're talking about the sixth mass extinction, what we want to do is educate people that, you know, if you're still driving around an internal combustion engine vehicle, if you're doing all this stuff, I want that to become like, you know, smoking in a restaurant.
Right.
You know, or, you know, if you're eating meat, you know, do that outside around the corner with the smokers. because once you start to see the impact that that's having, you know, and people draw those lines, they're going to be saying, you know, people that are aware would be going, how could you do that? You know, and you think that's crazy to think that. But, like, you know, 1998, we were still smoking on planes.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as a wonderful example. And to tell that to kids now, they would have a difficult time processing that. Smoking on planes? Really? You did that?
Yeah, really, exactly.
But now, so you want to continue that same attitude to other habits and behaviors?
Yeah, we're evolving. You know, we're evolving slower than I would like. I know we're all going to reach that same place. There's just no physical way that, you know, humanity can all be eating meat for a living. You know, that's the way to go forward is to start eating more plants. Which, you know, like I said, all protein comes from plants. So why wouldn't you go for that? You know, the gladiators, they were called the barley men because they were vegetarians. They were vegans.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's a myth. It's the most dangerous myth in the world that you need protein from animals to get your
substance and health, etc. If you just join us, we're speaking with Louis Sayhoya. I hope we pronounce that.
No, there's an S at the end. Sayhoyas.
Sayhoyas. He's the director of the documentary Racing Extinction. It's going to have its premiere
11:30
tomorrow.
Yeah.
At the Mark.
I can't believe it.
The big moment is approaching.
I'll be there. Are you going to be there? I have a ticket.
No, I'll be there
you
later.
Have
I have a ticket.
It's sold out.
If I mention your name, free popcorn. At least
a Kleenex. I'll give you a free Kleenex.
So I want to hear a little bit about how you got into this this business of making documentary films. You know, you used to be a photographer.
It's a business?
Yeah.
They don't make
Maybe
money
that's
doing
the wrong
this.
Word. The hobby of the passion. But how did you make that shift from being, you know, a photographer for National Geographic and jump into film?
Well, a buddy of mine, he was actually from Utah. His name was Jim Clark. He became my dive buddy. He's a serial entrepreneur. He started Netscape. You know, he invented the first commercial internet browser. We became dive buddies, and he did another. He was the Steve Jobs of his day. He had a company called Silicon Graphics, which was like very high speed, you know, desktop computing back. You know, when I was a kid growing up, and he made three companies from scratch, all worth over $1 billion. Now he's my dive buddy. So, like when John F. Kennedy called to put Americans on the moon by the end of the decade, Jim was working for Boeing for the Saturn project, and he said, you know, he was working on the computers that was actually the bottleneck for the whole system, and he heard John F. Kennedy give that rousing speech, and he was like, there's no way it's going to happen unless those computers get sped up. So he did that. He sped them up 20-fold. He's a kid in college, and he speeds up the computers 20-fold and makes the whole space program viable. Now, this guy becomes my buddy, and we're diving all around the world, and every time, you know, he'd pick me up on his planes, we go on the world's biggest yachts that he built, and we're seeing the oceans disappear before our eyes. Every time we go back to, say, the Galapagos, we're seeing this devastation. And while we were at the Galapagos for the third time, we saw fishermen illegally fishing in a marine sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And he turned to me and said, somebody should do something about this. And I said, well, how about you and I? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, we'll use your money in my eye and we'll make films. And I had never made a film before. And
it was a bold proposal then.
It was. But you know, when you're sitting around a guy that's like your childhood hero and now your best friend, and that sort of greatness, that aspiration rubs off on you. Because I'm seeing this guy, change the world with every business he creates. And I thought, well, I want a piece of that, but I don't want to make money. I want to actually use that idea, to use my vision to actually help save the planet. And it sounds really crazy, but, here's a guy that actually, does change the world almost with everything he does. So we started this organization called the Oceanic Preservation Society, OPS. And The Cove was our first film. And The Cove, it's the most winning documentary in history. It was the first film to sweep all the film guilds. It has a little gold man somewhere that people do their selfies with. It, and the film is actually about dolphin hunting, but they're killing about 2/3 less dolphins now in Japan because of that movie. Films are films to me are a weapon of mass construction. You can use you drop a bomb on somebody, you kill them, but you drop a documentary, you
know,
change
what?
Them.
You drop a mind bomb, which is who we're going to be talking to next. Jerry Rothwell, director of How to Change the World.
Saw
and that's
last
a term
night.
They used, a mind bomb, and how to use media as the message to get out environmental stewardship and responsibility.
Yeah.
We only have a couple minutes, Louis. So you did mention The Cove. What is going on there now? I mean, have behaviors changed there?
Yeah, like I said,
it's such a culturally ingrained thing.
But cultures and social situations, they evolve, and we're helping them speed up.
Yeah.
Like I said, they're killing about 2/3 less dolphins in Japan right now, and this is because we do these educational campaigns to people in the town, people in these, they still hunt dolphins and eat them.
Yeah.
And, all dolphin meat is toxic, not just a little bit. It has anywhere from 5 to 5,000 times more mercury than allowed by Japanese law. So we've been pushing that message out. Every time I talk to a Japanese, media concern, I try to use the word mercury in every sentence so they can't edit me out. Because, because if you talk about humanity issues or these animals are more sentient, intelligent, they'll say to us, well, what about cows, pigs, and chickens? And I would say, yeah, what about them? But if you eat pigs, if they had 5,000 times more mercury than allowed by anybody's law, I'd say, foreigner or not, I'd hope somebody come and tell us what's what.
Right.
So the film is really still doing its work out there. One of the problems, in SeaWorld stock, you look at SeaWorld stock, it's dropped half in just the last year, partly because of our movie and partly because of another one that we helped spawn called Blackfish.
Right.
But we have a divestment campaign going on to everybody, all the major concerns that own SeaWorld stock. And, the last quarter, they dropped, like I said, they dropped by half. You see the spike of their, the stock that day, they lost like $750 million. That's directly related to our divestment campaign.
Right.
So we're not just making movies. We're working on campaigns behind the issues to solve the issues. To me, it's not movies that we're making. We're starting movements. So we're working on that. Now we tackle the biggest one in the world, getting humanity off of fossil fuels because we're actually killing the planet.
Well, the name of the film is Racing Extinction. The director is Louis Saihoyas. Thank you very much, Louis, for taking the time to chat with you this morning on the Sundance Reel, and we'll look forward to seeing the film. It's going to be shown 7 times.
Wow, cool. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in.
Cool. Lots of luck, Louis. All right, let's take a break for some underwriters. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here at Whole Foods Market Cafe. Come on down. It's 5% Give Back Day. Or Giving Day here with
That's
Whole
right.
Foods. 5% of their proceeds goes to KPCW. So we'll be back with the director or representatives from How to Change the World. It's the Sundance Reel. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts, here to tell you about Park City Round Valley Clinic, a proud supporter of KPCW. At the Park City Round Valley Clinic, you'll find family practice medicine, pain management, urology, sports medicine, and internal medicine doctors. They're all accepting new patients, and some even have evening appointments available. The Park City Round Valley Clinic is located at 750 Round Valley Drive, just a stone's throw away from Park City Medical Center, and is part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street featuring traditional favorites, as well as Midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
Hi,
This is State Farm Insurance Agent Benita Vanderquay, longtime volunteer DJ and sponsor of KPCW. With over 22 years of State Farm experience, I assist clients with their insurance and financial planning needs. I offer insurance and financial services, including life, health, auto, and homeowners insurance. I can be reached at 435-657-2220.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital and proud supporter of KPCW. I've told you about Park City Medical Center being a great place to work, but it's also a great place to volunteer. If you're looking to make a difference in your community, consider volunteering at the hospital. We are looking for people who can volunteer in three-hour shifts, Monday through Friday, from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Our volunteers take meals to patients, deliver flowers and gifts, help with projects and special events, and truly make a difference in the healing process and in our patients' lives. If you'd like to become a hospital volunteer, visit parkcitymedicalcenter.org to apply.
Welcome back to KPCW's Sundance Reel, live from Whole Foods, the cafe at Whole Foods, two-hour. It's our annual show. We do this every year. We've done it every year for the past, 26 years?
Something closer to five.
And I, but we've been doing this for 7 years. And here's one thing hopefully we'll get to. Every year, we interview, say, five or six directors, producers, et cetera, and one or more of those films goes on to win an award. So we think we have a little bit of a good look. Maybe it's Whole Foods. Maybe it's us. But
we'll take the credit.
Let's move on to our next guest. He's Jerry Rothwell. He's the director of How to Change the World, a film about Greenpeace and the formation of Greenpeace, the challenges it faced, some of their early projects, and kind of their evolution from beginning to today. And so, Jerry, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what. Take the first couple of minutes and just kind of arc out the story for our listeners about what this film is about.
Okay, so it's the story of the people who founded Greenpeace in the 1970s, and it sort of tells their story between about 1971, when they sailed a boat into a nuclear test zone to try and stop U.S. Underground nuclear tests, to 1978-79, when they set up Greenpeace International, which is really the organization we know today. And in the process of that, really kind of gave away this sort of baby they'd created to the world.
Right. And it was interesting that, yeah, their first efforts, Bob Hunter, a journalist writing for a paper in Vancouver, was kind of the catalyst to getting this started.
Yeah, I mean, Bob was very much the person who defined Greenpeace's character. You know, he was this very charismatic kind of gonzo journalist who he'd written a couple of novels, a couple of books about change, was very tuned in to the changes that were happening in the late 60s, the peace movement, the countercultural movement. And he had a job at the Vancouver Sun where he would write a daily column reporting on the counterculture. The Vancouver Sun is quite a conservative newspaper, but they had this kind of hippie journalist on the fringes of its columns, and that was Bob. And he went on the first voyage to Amchitka in the Aleutian Islands, up against the American nuclear test as a reporter. And I think it was on that voyage, really, that he kind of turned from reporter to activist. He kind of made that transition from someone who was writing about this movement and to leading it.
So the initial group was just five, or him and four or five other individuals that just kind of showed up at times.
Well, initially it was a group who called themselves the Don't Wake a Wave Committee. They were concerned about the possibility of the nuclear tests sparking tidal waves down the West Coast.
Right.
The success of that voyage, I mean, they didn't actually even reach the island. They had to turn back. But the publicity impact of their voyage ended with a cancellation of tests. And I think Hunter realized the media potential of that kind of action of, if you like, as he called it, putting your body where your mouth is. You know, getting. Somewhere where you can bear witness and get kind of images into the mass media of these things.
So what was it that sparked your interest in this topic and your decision to cover it? Because as you said, it's a story from the 70s.
Well, I mean, I guess I can remember Greenpeace growing up. But for me, it really started. I was kind of doing some other work that took me into the Greenpeace archive, and I realized there were sort of 1,500 cans of 16 millimeter film which hadn't been opened for 40 years, and no one really kind of knew what was on them. And that's always the kind of lure of the invisible, you know, the lure of the excitement of just basically what's on those cans. And that took me to that was footage that was shot on the first Greenpeace voyages.
Yeah.
And that took me to Hunter's writings, which are fantastic. You know, they're kind of not... He wrote 13 books, a lot of them about Greenpeace. They're not sort of promotional books. They're deeply sort of honest, funny, full of self-doubt. It's kind of a fascinating
right.
to write.
But these thousands of feet of film were just... No one had ever bothered to, either make something of them as a history of the movement.
I think what had happened is they'd shot this material, they'd made it into campaigning films, so they hadn't really sort of looked at that material from what it said about them,
right?
What it said about
internally
the people involved, yeah. And so there was a lot of material which has never been shown, never made into films.
Oh, it's amazing film footage, and I guess some reason why it wasn't displayed because there was a lot of strife and disagreement and disorder, like any new organization or grassroots effort. There's always going to be multiple attitudes and ideas.
Sure. I mean, I like to say it's the kind of story of any group, you know, where this bunch of people come together with a passion or a vision for something, but then they find they also have to kind of deal with each other and each other's different takes on that vision and to get agreement, and they'll start to fragment in different ways.
And who's the leader and who doesn't want to be a leader?
Sure.
Yeah. Many of the countercultural... attitude or idea was, I don't want to be a leader. I want to be part of a movement, but, you know, perhaps they were reluctant leaders or so.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Bob Hunter, who I think was a very charismatic character, he was able to sort of solidify this group of different people into a real force. But he was someone who would have said, you know, I don't want to be a leader. He hated leaders.
Yeah.
So you have all this great historic footage. Are you able to sort of graft in current day interviews with people's, you know, perspectives looking back?
Yeah. So I mean, we were very fortunate that all of the sort of key founding members were really happy to be interviewed. So you know, they kind of tell the story, and it's their take on that material and on each other and on what they achieved. So it's also a bit of a story about kind of growing up and maturing and growing older, because these are 60, 70, 80-year-old guys who are looking back on this moment when they were maybe, I think Paul Watson was 19 at the time, at the beginning. You know, they're very young men, and they're looking back on this period that was so formative for them.
And at least one individual, one of the family members, has actually kind of taken a stand against Greenpeace.
That's right. I mean,
so that's how ideas evolve, attitudes evolve. Well, I want to... You know, so they come back from this attempted sale to Amchitka to protest this planned nuclear explosion, which goes off as planned, and they felt that it was a failure. They felt like, oh, we didn't get there, we didn't do anything. You know, we for one reason or another, we had to turn back, and yet they were received as kind of heroes, and actually their message was successfully broadcast out. So their next effort, though, was really interesting. It was a real big shift to go from nuclear arms and nuclear bombs to whales. What was going on there?
Well, I mean, the crucial person in that story really is this scientist, Paul Spong, who'd been sort of charged with doing psychological experiments on one of the first captive orca whales in the Vancouver Aquarium, Skarner. And he'd started this experiment looking into the whale's vision. The whale very quickly got the tests, would get 100% right.
Right.
And then on one day flipped and went from getting the tests 100% right to getting them 100% wrong. And Paul couldn't kind of really work out what was going on, but what he decided was that the whale was starting to experiment with him and that this was a kind of deliberate refusal of the test. And that led him to think about whales differently, and to decide really that the whale wanted to be free, which actually got him the sack from the Vancouver Aquarium.
Right.
whereupon he kind of made contact with Hunter because of the Amchitka voyage, and looked at how could that kind of action, that sort of bearing witness, save the whales, which at that time were being hunted to extinction.
Yeah, and eventually, you know, they go out, and it's a great story. They get all the details, but they go out and they find some Russian trawlers. And that image is amazing. I mean, it's quite graphic, too. But that was part of the idea. I mean, it's one thing to get in the way and try to stop the whaling activity. That was their original plan. But then they realized that they maybe got something better. We got this on film. We got these whales being harpooned, and they weren't just adults. They were juveniles or baby or undersized whales. These ships, they looked gruesome. I mean, the visual image of these rusting hulls with blood spurting from them. It's an unbelievable image. It reminded me of, like, I mean, that's evil. I mean, and plus they were Russian. I think that played a big role, too. Mm-hmm. But again, that was an example of the image bearing witness, carrying maybe a greater message, helping them more than just trying to stop the whaling.
Yeah, I mean, I think for Hunter, it was quite deliberate. You know, he realized what they needed, that an image just of harpooning was not really a news story. What was a news story was human beings risking their lives for a whale. So he kind of came up with the idea that if we can get some footage of us in this tiny little dinghy in between this huge, hulking, rusting harpoon boat and a whale as a harpoon is fired, you know, that's the image we want to get. And sure enough, you know, it took them a long time to find the whalers, but when they found them, that was exactly what happened.
So I'm interested in hearing how this film kind of relates to your past work, because you haven't always been working on environmental, you know, issues or documentaries.
Yeah, I mean, I think the films I've made in the past have a real range of subjects. I mean, the last one I made was about two young girls in Ethiopia who wanted to be long-distance runners. The one before that was about a sperm donor and his many offspring. So in a way, there's kind of no commonality in the subject matter. I mean, that's one of the joys of documentary making, is that it can take you into someone's world. You can kind of experience it in kind of an intimate way and bring that back for an audience. You know, I guess there's probably a similarity of approach. I mean, I think the films are similar in style. I mean, I guess I'm really interested in groups and how they work, in interpersonal dynamics, into, you know, I guess the meat and veg of documentary.
Right. Any surprises in the course of the arc of kind of, you know, like any documentary, I guess you kind of set out with an idea, maybe some fuzzy goals and objectives of where the arc of the story should go, and then it can change the process.
I think, I mean, the archive footage held lots of surprises for us because there were no kind of screeners of it. We couldn't really afford to even look at it, to digitize it, whilst we were fundraising for the film. So we knew some of the material, we knew what was there, but there was also these two suitcases of 150 quarter-inch reel-to-reels, which we knew were the audio that had been recorded and related somehow to these 1,500 reels of
wow.
16 mil. And when you bring those two things together and you find a bit of audio that syncs, it's a kind of magical moment, because suddenly, you know, suddenly you're there.
Right. There's the story. So how many years in the effort?
I mean, the first beginnings of the idea were in 2007, so I guess that's kind of 7 years, but a lot of that is sort of fundraising.
Yeah.
And I was here last year at Sundance pitching the film, and really it's sort of been since that moment to now that production's been happening.
Is this the first film that you've brought to Sundance?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's really, really exciting. I mean, I guess it's every sort of filmmaker's dream to bring a film to Sundance. It was on the opening night, which is really exciting. So yeah.
Right, and the opening night is
last night.
Oh.
Yeah.
We missed it. Well, Nell and I had...
There's a lot of small screenings.
Nell and I had a chance to see it.
Cool.
And it's a fantastic film. I mean, like I say, the footage is amazing. And like I say, it's at times quite graphic, but that, again, that was the point to bring home. Like we were saying, it was one thing to... Their plans to paint... Paul Watson wanted to paint the baby seals' fur green, and thereby rendering their fur useless. But Bob Hunter kind of, I don't want to say cave, but just kind of changed his mind and kind of recognized that maybe there was another idea, and maybe just filming, as gruesome as that was, filming it could and then broadcasting that, again, bearing witness was a part of a bigger part of the message there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the film, you know, the title of the film, How to Change the World, was something we came to very early, and it's not like a recipe. It's like an exploration of many different ideas about what effective change is. So there's a constant question in the film about compromise and about to what extent should we, for example, take on board the fact that the Newfoundland sealers are also
that was their livelihood.
Yeah,
that was their livelihood. This is part of their culture. Yeah.
Exactly. So all those kind of issues sort of play out in the film as they played out in the group, and they divided the group, and they'll probably divide the film audience too.
And then it slowly divides them.
Yeah.
Over time.
Yeah.
So we have a couple minutes left. Before we let you go, what's next for you? I see you have another film in the hopper here.
Yeah, there's two films I'm sort of working on at the moment. One is called Sour Grapes, and it's about a guy who became a wine collector in the early 2000s, late 90s. Very successful, was one of the biggest wine collectors in the world, and then gradually people realized that he was selling fake wine to other collectors. The sort of center of the story is this Burgundy producer in France who realizes that his family's wine is being sold from a year that they didn't produce it. And he kind of tracks down what's happening to that wine and ultimately realizes that really substantial millions and millions of dollars worth of wine that's been put into the vintage wine industry is fake and has come from this one collector.
Fantastic. And that'll be available on Netflix?
It's a Netflix film, yeah.
Fantastic.
And I guess the end of this year. Maybe Sundance next year.
Yes, exactly.
We'll keep an eye out.
Okay, well, yeah, well, I hope you enjoy your stay here.
Thank you.
The film is How to Change the World. The director is Jerry Rothwell. He's kind enough to join us. It's about the origins of Greenpeace and the challenges they have, and the Greenpeace is still around and it's still very effective.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it's part of the establishment now. Yeah.
Yeah. So the film had its premiere last night, but it's going to be shown 5 more times over the course of the coming week.
And will you be at any of those screenings?
Yeah, I'm going to be at all of them.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
For Q&A?
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
oh.
Yeah.
You're the best.
Yeah, and we've got a couple of the Greenpeace guys over as well. So
some
of the original founders of Greenpeace are going to be there.
Paul Watson?
Yeah. No, not Paul, but Rex Weiler and Will Jackson. Yeah.
All right, fantastic.
Grab a ticket to that if you can.
See it if you can, How to Change the World. Thanks again, Jerry.
Thank you.
Let's take a break for some runners. We're at the top of the hour. Let's remind people that you're listening to KPCW, the Sundance Reel, our annual 2-hour special.
That's right, and this year it is sponsored in part by the Sky Wellness Collection. So thanks for your support.
All right, and come on down to Whole Foods if you want to support KPCW on Community Giving Day. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors and NPR news, and when we come back, we got a whole other set of directors and films we're going to be talking to. It's the Sundance Reel. Stay tuned.
Winter is in full swing at the Utah Olympic Park. The park is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Explore the Alf Ingen Ski Museum and Eccles 2002 Olympic Winter Games Museum, take a guided Olympic heritage tour, or watch athletes train while enjoying a hot beverage from the cafe. Parking and admission is free. Utah Olympic Park is a KPCW supporter and a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Beppler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You are listening to the Sundance Reel on KPCW Park City.